Welcome to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. We also stream online at cfuv.uvic.ca. I'm Liz, filling in for Chris this evening. Guerrilla Radio is also going to be changing to a new time and day on Wednesdays. You can tune in next week on the 13th at 1 p.m. to hear Chris. That'll be right after Democracy Now! And to the show at hand today, we're going to focus on the Unistoten camp and the caravan to Unistoten. Last month, I joined the caravan, a group of environmentalists, activists, permaculture gardeners, volunteers, and media, traveled 1,200 kilometers to the pipeline blockade near Houston, B.C. for the annual Action Camp. The week-long camp focused on decolonization work and cooperation between indigenous people and settlers to stop the pipelines. It's hosted at a permanent pipeline blockade that exists on that site and is occupied by the Unistoten clan of the Wet'suwet'en people. Currently, I'm working on a radio documentary about the blockade, and today I'll play two interviews with people who attended the camp that will be part of that documentary. In the second half of the show, we'll hear from Vanessa Gray from the Amjanong First Nation, which is located in the Chemical Valley in southern Ontario. She'll talk about the reality of living amongst the oil and gas industry and why she attended the Unistoten Action Camp. But to start today, I have an interview with Will Falk, who is an environmentalist involved in the caravan to Unistoten and also the local group Victoria Forest Action Network. We spoke last week after the caravan returned to Victoria.
Involved with Forest Action Network.
Yes, I am.
Can you explain what your involvement is with that?
Yeah, I went to the Unistoten camp in May, and through the screening process, I spoke with Zoe Blunt, who runs Forest Action Network, and I had been thinking for a long time that I was at a point in my life where I needed to get much more involved in environmental issues. So I asked Zoe, after she screened me, if, what kind of help she needed with stuff. Mm-hmm. She gave me a couple, like, legal research things to do. I have a law degree. I was a practicing attorney. After I did some of that, I asked her, you know, do you need any help, around Victoria? So after I got back from the camp in May, Zoe, said I could come back to Victoria and help her if I wanted. Mm-hmm. And so I asked her how long, you know, she needed help for, and she asked me, well, how long you got? And, I've been here helping her since then.
Mm-hmm. So you said that you realized you wanted to be more involved in environmental issues. Why environmental issues?
Well, I think for me it's as simple as there are no problems more pressing than the health of water, than the health of the soil, than the health of the air. Without clean water to drink, without healthy soil to grow our food in, without breathable air, all other problems simply cannot be addressed. So for me, the first thing, if we want to create a better world, the first thing we have to do is ensure that those three things are taken care of. And that's what I think environmentalism is at its core trying to do.
Mm-hmm. One thing that surprised me about traveling to the Unistoten camp was the number of Americans that were on the trip. Because I guess sort of, if you're living up here, you sort of think of it as primarily a Canadian issue, things like the pipelines and the tar sands. So why make the decision to come across the border up here to do this kind of environmental work rather than staying in the States?
Well, first of all, I think that fossil fuel issues are affecting all of us. So if the fossil fuel pipelines that are proposed, are built, they're going to be carrying combustible fossil fuels to markets in Asia and other places to be burnt. And we know that fossil fuels burning are what are contributing to climate change, are responsible for climate change. And, you know, I've heard that if you ask a reasonably intelligent fifth grader, how do you stop climate change that is produced by the burning of fossil fuels, that fifth grader will say, well, you stop burning fossil fuels. So the Unistoten camp is actually situated directly physically in the path of those pipelines. So it's one of the few places in the world where people are literally placing their body between the development of fossil fuels and the world.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I came to Canada, is because it's one of the few places where this frontline direct action against fossil fuels is happening.
Mm-hmm. And the first time you were at the Unistone camp was in May, is that right?
That's correct.
How did you hear about it?
Well, if you like enough pages, enough environmental pages on Facebook, you're bound to see all the calls for volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also a member of the environmental group Deep Green Resistance, which has had a great working relationship with the camp hosts at the Unistoten camp. And through our communications, that call for volunteers was also put out. So I heard it through both places.
Mm-hmm. The Unistoten camp is a really powerful place. Can you talk about going up there for the first time and what your initial impressions were and what you did when you were up there?
I went up for the May work camp, and the goal of the work camp was to construct a bunkhouse on the path of one of the proposed pipelines, to construct a traditional pit house in the path of another of the proposed pipelines, and to construct a permaculture garden in the path of another one of the proposed pipelines. I think that doing that work, doing physical, tangible labor, contributes to what my experience was in May. So it was such a powerful experience for me, because for the first time in my life, I was engaged in physically defending a land base, not just writing about it, not just talking about it, not just wishing and praying that fossil fuels would go away, but actually going up to a land base, hearing the river flowing by, listening to the wind through the tops of those pine trees, watching bear cubs play on the side of the road, and realizing that these things need to be physically defended. So mixing my sweat and my labor with that land base was the first time in my life where I could actually say, I'm physically present for this land. So that's why my experience was so powerful in May.
Mm-hmm. So when it came to organizing the caravan, were you working with Zoe and actually getting people together to go up there? And can you talk about some of the logistics of that?
Yes. So I think... just to explain myself, I couldn't organize my way out of a wet bag, right? Like, logistics, organization, simple logical thinking has never been my forte. So it was such a learning experience for me to be involved in organizing the caravan. There was so much involved from, you know, finding a willing driver to drive that school bus all the way up there, to prioritizing donations that came in. So we actually had to turn away fresh food donations because we just didn't have enough space on the bus. We were afraid that it would spoil on the way up, things like that. And then I think another thing, and more serious, is security issues when you have like an open call for volunteers to come to a place like the Unistoten camp. When you know, it's public online that the Unistoten camp is calling for people to come to the action camp. There's nothing really except for our own hunches and intuitions and questions that are keeping the RCMP away or members of corporations away. So that becomes an issue is, you know, not wanting to be over suspicious of people, but also recognizing that if somebody is maybe acting unusual or isn't answering questions about decolonization in a favorable way, I just found that to be an unsettling experience, actually, facing the fact that there are people in the community, in government, that would rather the Unistone camp did not exist.
Mm-hmm. Did you guys run into anybody that you suspected of being an infiltrator or actually got up there and thought, or was second-guessing some people?
You know, I personally don't know much about that or whether that happened. I know that there have been people in the past that, you know, rubbed the camp hosts the wrong way or acted in inappropriate ways once they were at the camp and were asked to leave. But I don't know specifically of those examples, or I did not experience anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was, I hadn't really considered that, I guess. I went through the interview process with you and Zoe, but I sort of felt like it was more like just making sure it was somebody that was, you know, going out for a specific reason rather than just, you know, going on like a holiday or something.
I mean, another part of the screening process is just making sure that non-Indigenous peoples are aware of the fact that we occupy stolen land, land that is only available to us through centuries of genocide. And then not just that realization, but understanding how we have to think about that in terms of our relationship with the land here and with Indigenous peoples who still have very strong cultures, who are born with the knowledge that their ancestors were murdered, and not just their ancestors, but people they may know now, have been killed on their own land. And so it can be a problem when people get to the camp and they're confronted with this knowledge. And I think if you haven't taken some time to think about the fact that you're a settler on stolen land, if you're a non-Indigenous person, can quite frankly slap you in the face when you're at the camp.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just some of the screening process is helping people understand that there needs to be a little personal reflection before you get up there, just so that you've had time to maybe come to grips with that in yourself before you're confronted with that knowledge.
Mm-hmm. I went up mostly thinking about focusing on the environmental aspect of what the Unistone camp represents, but there's this huge, I don't know, the focus was much more on the Indigenous leadership and the sort of Indigenous cultural and political resurgence that's happening in Canada, and I would imagine also in the United States. The first time you went up there, were you expecting that as well, or did you have an idea of what it was all about?
Yes, I was expecting it. I think for me, through my own experiences and my own, reading and talking with Indigenous folks, it's always been apparent to me that at least on Turtle Island in so-called North America, the survival of humanity is bound up in the struggles of Indigenous people, because in my opinion, they've long offered examples about what it means to live in balance with their land base. So for where I come from in San Diego, so-called San Diego, California, we know that the Kumeyaay people live there for 12,000 years in balance with the land in San Diego. And in the last 200 years, settlers have trashed that land. You know, there's no water in California. So to me, helping or supporting Indigenous peoples in their own struggles is supporting those traditional knowledges that I think we're going to have to learn if we're going to make it through the what can not be described by any other word than out-and-out crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So I was expecting it when I went up to the camp. You know, I think they make it quite clear that they are standing up for what they believe are their responsibilities, responsibilities that the land has communicated to them and their ancestors and that have been passed down from generation to generation. it's a beautiful thing to hear that you have a responsibility to the land base and that the Unist'ot'en camp is formed on a love and a commitment to honoring those responsibilities.
Mm-hmm. Are you hopeful about the success of the Unist'ot'en camp and other sort of planned encampments like it to prevent the pipelines, to end fossil fuel use?
Hope is a tricky and dangerous word. I've heard hope defined as a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency over, and that's really important. So you would say if you got on an airplane, I hope that the airplane doesn't crash. Mm-hmm. Because you really, once you strap into the airplane, you don't have any agency over that airplane. But you don't say when you wake up in the morning, I hope I eat today. You just make sure that you eat. You have agency over that food. So when I say, if I say that I hope the Unist'ot'en camp defeats pipelines, which again, it's all of us that are going to be needed to stop the pipelines, but I hope that the Unist'ot'en camp survives these pipelines. I think I'm giving up my own agency in that struggle. So I would rather say that I cannot let the Unist'ot'en camp fall to the pipelines. And I just don't want to, I don't want hope part of the equation. I want it to be, I want all of us to recognize the agency we have. Mm-hmm. And that goes for the rest of the environmental movement. I think for too long and for too many of us, we've relied on hope, where, we really should just make sure that fossil fuels stop.
Now on this side of the action camp, do you think it was a successful camp? Do you think that people came out of there that are going to be actually following up on things that, you know, you get really caught up in it, you want to help, you're saying you want to help and do these things. Do you think that there's going to be follow through? Do you get that sense from people that were there?
Yeah, it's something I've been thinking a lot about. It remains to be seen, in my opinion, whether it was a successful action camp. If we define a successful camp as a large number of people coming together and sharing in the energy that we all brought up there and sort of refreshing our cynicism, may say, then yeah, it was a successful camp. But if we define a successful camp in stopping the pipelines, then, you know, we'll start to see whether people are committed to stopping the pipelines based on their continuing commitment to what they learned up at the Unist'ot'en camp, what they heard the Unist'ot'en clan ask of them, what they heard elders ask of them, and what we talked about with each other and what we all think that we need to be doing to stop the pipeline. So I hate to take that sort of realist view on things because I do think it's important that we share in that energy together and that sense of community that's up there. But to stop the pipelines isn't going to be done through feelings of community. Stopping the pipelines is going to be done by doing the work to stop the pipelines. So it'll be a successful camp when there are no more pipelines.
Mm-hmm. You're involved in two environmental groups, as you've said. Do you think that there's enough cooperation within the environmental movement itself to actually achieve the goals it wants to achieve, or does there need to be more cohesion there?
There is absolutely not enough cooperation amongst environmental groups. And we don't have to look any farther than the fact that between 100 and 200 species are going extinct today. In the United States, 95% of the old growth forests are gone. I just read a stat this morning for a piece I'm writing. 250 trees around the world are cut down a second. So actually just this morning, an article came out in the New Yorker about some of the conflict between the transgender rights movement and radical feminists about you know how we define gender. how we define women's space. You have environmental groups denouncing each other over this issue. You have environmental groups refusing to work with each other over this issue. And the way I see it, the world is burning, and there are people that are showing up with buckets of water, and this horizontal hostility is just people turning those buckets of water away. I don't think we have time to continue to engage in horizontal hostility. Like I said, we're getting beat so badly that there just isn't time.
Have you ever had the opportunity to speak to someone who is, like, directly who is involved either with one of these mineral extraction or oil and gas companies? And what, how did that conversation go, if it's ever happened?
Yeah. Actually, my father works for Pacific Gas and Electric in the San Francisco Bay Area in California. Mm-hmm. And my dad's worked in gas transmission. He's worked for pipelines for my entire life. So... yeah, what comes from those conversations?
Yeah, does he, what does he think about what you do?
My father has been wonderfully supportive of the work that I do. He does not believe that any more pipelines should be built. He is involved, in the so-called pipeline safety side of things. So it's his job to make sure that, there aren't spills on pipelines, there aren't explosions on pipelines. And, you know, my dad is, I believe, a deeply honest man. I think that perhaps, you know, 35 years ago when he was graduating from college with a chemical engineering degree, I don't think that it was as apparent to many settler people, I'll say, many non-indigenous folks, how destructive these pipelines were, how destructive fossil fuels were, and even how destructive natural gas, which is something that my dad has been involved in his entire life. So when I speak with him, I think it's more a situation of feeling a lot of financial responsibilities to his family, and not really knowing at his age, at 58 years old, how he can do something different. And I think that's a pretty common view shared by many people in that generation. It in no way excuses what's going on or inaction from that generation, because they do have material resources, they do have skill sets, and they do have power that many of us younger people simply don't have. So we need them too. But yeah, that's how those conversations go.
That sort of came up at the camp about the lonelier side of being an activist and being alienated from friends and family, which I think many people can relate to, not necessarily for being like an environmental activist or something. There's always something that, you know, can cause like family tensions or tensions between friends. Has that been your experience, that you have been alienated by any friends or family because of political or environmental decisions that you've taken?
I don't think that, at least in my experience, most of my friends or family have convictions that run deeply enough for them to completely alienate me, say. So really what it looks like is, you're not going to make any money being an environmental activist. And in fact, many environmental activists would rather see the system of money collapse, right? So you're actively working to undermine something that most people hold very dearly in our society. So the alienation is more like not being able to find someone who understands the emotions that you're feeling about things. Not finding people that are willing to occupy a mindset that sees the problems clearly enough, that faces those problems, and then demands that they do something about it. So I think in my white, liberal, middle-class background, what that means is, people say things like, yeah, I don't think you're wrong, but it's just too depressing for me to think about. You know, I can't go to work every day and think about these things and maintain my mental health. which, you know, I guess I can understand things are pretty scary, but when the future of life on the planet depends upon it, is that the quote that you want to take with you to your grave? You know, that's what alienation looks like to me. It's more a unwillingness to visit the emotional and spiritual places that I think more clear-sighted people visit all the time.
So what happens next? The Action Camp is done, but obviously your work continues. As far as your role with Vic Fan and with Deep Green Resistance, what are you working on now?
Well, just because the Action Camp is finished does not mean that corporations will stop trying to build pipelines and every other environmental disaster that you can imagine. The camp listed some pretty, tangible things that they need. They need fundraising all the time. They need bodies up present at the camp. Just a couple days ago, they evicted a helicopter full of, I believe, Trans Canada workers that landed in the camp. And they told them, you are not welcome here, and if we catch you again, we'll take your helicopter. So they need people, they need bodies up there helping to patrol the area. They need things as simple and as human as preserved foods. So with Vic Fan, we're going to continue with our fundraising efforts. We are going to continue to help facilitate rides up to the camp. And we're also going to talk about and try and solicit more long-term commitments from people in Victoria and the Vancouver Island community to, like I said, make a commitment to keep supporting the camp in the long term. There are things that we can do in our community to help the Unistoten camp, to take some of the pressure off of Indigenous peoples who are literally putting their bodies on the line for natural communities. That's what we're working on right now.
Mm-hmm. If people want to support and offer their support, where can they find out more information?
Yeah, you can donate through wildcoast.ca. Yeah, I think there's a PayPal link right on that website. We have a Facebook page, Caravan to Unistoten Camp. And there are email links at the wildcoast.ca website where if people have tangible skills that they would be interested in dedicating to the cause as it is, we would love to hear from them. We need people with media experience. We need writers. We need people with fundraising skills. We need outgoing, extroverted people that like to hear themselves talk and can get the message out. We need people with marketing experience. One thing that corporations are better than anybody at is creating messaging that is deeply persuasive to the general public. And we need people with that sort of acumen that can, you know, I keep thinking of like guerrilla marketeers or like counterintelligence MBA, you know, grads that like can go in and use some of that business, acumen to, create competing, narratives around, places like the Unistoten camp. So, I mean, it literally takes a village to stop the pipelines, but the cool thing is we live in a pretty big village and there's people with a lot of skills. So it's our hope that we can get people to make, some long-term and committed, statements of support to the camp through action.
All right. I think that's time, but thank you for joining me today.
Yeah. Thank you very much for having me. It was great.
All right, that was an interview with Will Falk, an environmentalist here working with Victoria Forest Action Network, who was on the caravan to the Unistoten pipeline blockade. If you are interested in hearing any of the content you hear
today. If you want to hear it again, we will be podcasting the program, and you can access it at cfuv.uvic.ca. All right, Vanessa Gray is a member of the Amjanong First Nation Reservation in the Chemical Valley in southern Ontario at the Unist'ot'en Camp. Vanessa sat down with me and Irene Dembrunis from our sister station in Montreal, CKUT, to talk about why she traveled to the blockade and the challenges her community faces in the face of the oil and gas industry. You'll hear me asking questions in the first half of the interview, and in the second half, Irene asks some more questions. We shared the interview.
So you traveled a long way to get here. Why is it so important for you to attend a gathering like this?
It's important for me because this is the beginning stages to a long road of resisting a company here in this territory. And so where I come from is the result of not resisting corporations. And so I live in a very toxic place compared to here. So it's important for me to bring youth out here to see that there is clean water and fresh air out there somewhere. And there's little of it left, so we need to protect it.
I was talking to you guys, I think on like the second day or something, about being from the Chemical Valley. Can you explain what that is and what that means for things like water?
So the Chemical Valley is made up of 63 high-emitting facilities within a 50-kilometer radius of our small community, which is located on the St. Clair River. So we're also a border city where there's a lot of freighters that come in and out of our area. And so on one side, we have Suncor loading dock, and then we have Shell loading dock. And then so where all of these oil companies are currently right now, including Imperial Oil and Enbridge, all of these companies are densely tucked into, like, right next door to us. And so a lot of their pipelines come right through underneath us already, and it has been like that. And then so this creates a lot of health problems for the people in Amjanong. We see a 39% of women experiencing stillbirths and miscarriages. We see high cancer rates, and we see 39% of kids needing to use a puffer to breathe. And so our air quality is really terrible because of, like, all of this industry densely located next to us. And so along with the Chemical Valley being there already, these companies also spill and have releases once in a while. And when that happens, we hear an alarm sound off. We're supposed to go inside, go indoors from wherever you are, shut all your windows, and then turn on the radio and listen for your next steps. And so that's the reality I come from. That's the reality of living on the front line of many oil companies all at once. So the idea of clean water and healthy air and land is a little far-fetched for me, myself, and youth that come from the Chemical Valley. So that relationship with water is suddenly there again. So yeah, that's why it's so important.
That is wild about the alarm telling you to go indoors when there's a spill or something. How often has that happened to you?
It was once or twice when they evacuated us, where someone would come door to door late at night and say, "You have to leave your home, it's unsafe here." And they put us up in a hotel twice now. But it's generally 4 to 6 times a month they have a spill or release. They sound the alarm off every Monday for testing. And that's also, like, when they actually report the spill or release. Not all the time they report it. Sometimes you'll just smell something really strong in the air, and then you know that there's been something released in the air. And then it will be, like, hours later after there's been an incident that they'll finally sound off the alarm after we're all well aware that there's something going on. So it's very often, and it's continuous abuse and torture to the indigenous people living right next door in this condition.
You're here to, partly to talk about like solidarity and then looking at natural spaces that are still here. As far as when you're at home, do you feel like you have much of a voice? Are there people listening to what's going on or fighting for change? What's that like at home?
At home, I've noticed that the youth are more open to the idea of decolonization and not focusing on the economy as the number one priority, because at that younger stage it means a little less, and having that connection with the land is more important. And so it's easier to gain that support from young people and have them understand that this is wrong. But also, what I'm doing here at the Unistone Camp is bringing youth here to see that there is something else out there, and that we do have something to protect. And this isn't the end of it. Like, the Chemical Valley is harsh and continuously toxic tale, but we need to keep going with this movement.
At the caucus this morning, you had a chance to talk about sort of the wish list for what your specific part of the movement is looking for. Can you talk a little bit about what you guys were looking for?
I would like to start a restoration project in Amjinong, where there's a small pond called Inkijig that is highly contaminated and has been for years. A long, long time ago, I guess I talked to a few others, and they told me that they used to like have community events there, and it used to be like the place to be, but now it's not, it's just not a safe place, so people don't go there. And so I'd like to reintroduce native species to naturally clean the area again.
Do you have much support within your own community and perhaps like outside of your community as well?
Yeah, I've been working with allies in the Toronto area with Rising Tide and my affinity group there, who have been supporting me for as long as I've been doing my work. And the university, York University of Toronto, has Professor Dana Scott there, has been supporting me. And then most recently I've been working with the University of Manitoba, who there's a prof there that would like to start working on the Inkijig project too. So I do get support, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a timeline for your project, or are you just getting started at this point?
Most of my projects so far have been pretty short term, and I'm often running around at the last minute and trying to do things within weeks at a time, and weeks or months at a time to get things done, and it's usually pretty crazy and stressful. And so I'm pretty excited for this next project, because it's going to be a long-term project where we're going to continuously monitor the site by continuously testing it, and then testing the plants there, looking at the progress of the change and what it was like before, and then also turning it into a film project where we film the process, but also interview elders about what was there, what happened to get to this state, and then we'll talk to youth about where this can go to, where how can this continue on in Amjinong.
In sort of a broader sense of the movement, as far as like indigenous political and cultural resurgence goes, how does this a camp like this factor in to your own work and I guess this sort of fight for liberation?
This camp allows myself and the youth I bring here to network and then to meet other cool folks from all around who are also doing their own projects, and to allow myself to heal, because this isn't, like I said, this isn't anything like Amjinong where I come from. And I like seeing the youth go down to the river so many times to fill up their water bottle, because they're thirsty and that's where they get their water, and it's still mind-blowing to think about them doing that. And Yeah, I don't know. I think it's a big healing process too, but it's also to empower them to continue working and do what they can and evolve into their own beings and then do their work where they feel like it needs to be done.
I was wondering if we could talk a bit about Enbridge Line 9. It's really cool to sit down and talk to you because I feel like me coming from so-called Montreal and you over in Amgenang, like we're at both ends of this pipeline that was approved a few months ago. And one of the questions that I've been hearing a lot on my end in so-called Montreal is, well, what happens now? What about Line 9? Is that it? It's been approved. And so I'm going to turn that question around on you. What does happen now? What are you guys planning over in Amgenang?
Well, with Line 9 being approved by the National Energy Board, that was no surprise. The grassroots organizations I've been working with have always worked knowing that was happening, and so we've always continued our work. We put a little bit of work into disturbing the hearings and putting that rally together. And so now I'm working with a few Indigenous women to connect all the Line 9 communities, First Nations communities being affected by the pipeline, to connect each other. Because along with this Line 9 fight, there has been NGO support for the white folks along the line, and there really hasn't been a lot of focus on the Indigenous folks being affected on this issue. And I think that's where the Line 9, I don't know, movement went wrong, was putting all the focus on NGOs and their funds and how they could help, how they felt that appealing to white people with white people in danger of this pipeline was the way to go. But really, the Indigenous people do have the rights to the land and could bring this to court and could have stopped this pipeline. But there really wasn't support or focus on those communities. And so it wasn't there then, but we want to make it there now.
Is it possible that you guys can still bring Line 9 to court? Can you guys still, you know, protest this in court at all?
Amgenang, no. They have, the chief and council in Amgenang feel that they use enough funds to go through with this. But the Chippewas of the Thames are our only hope at the moment to put an end to Line 9. And so they have decided to go through court with this matter, and we will be in solidarity with them all the way.
And if any listeners want to find out about how they can get involved in organizing against Line 9, are there websites we can go to? How can we stay in touch?
Line 9, the best bet is Rising Tide. They have Rising Tide Toronto has their Twitter and Facebook account, and I believe a website. I can't remember last time I've been to the website, but I think it is there, yeah.
You can Google it and probably find it.
Yeah,
and you also, there's your website as well, amgenangsolidarity.com.org?
.com, yeah. We have a website, and then we have a Facebook account and Twitter, but we're known as Take Action ASAP on Twitter, and then we are ASAP on Facebook, Amgenang and Sarnia Against Pipelines. Yeah, so you can reach us there.
I'm going to backtrack a bit here. In order to enter the Unistoten camp, everyone has to go through the Free Prior and Informed Consent Protocol. Could you talk about your impressions of the protocol and maybe talk about, has your community ever used a protocol like that?
Well, the protocol is due to the fact that this is unceded territory, so that's unique to this area. I think it's great that they do it, because I think that's part of their culture. And for my area, like I said, it is just industry. Where we're living now isn't considered a community. We're considered industry because we're so close to facilities. And so I think industry seems to have more of the say of who goes where with their own security. And so that's where we're at, where I come from.
Do you have anything else that you would like to add?
Yeah. I guess for people who are in the place of living close to a lot of industry, keep in mind that there is still reason to fight back here at the Unistone camp. It's land that is healing and is strong, but we all need to be in the same boat in concerns of defending the land and standing in solidarity with Indigenous people.
Thank you very much for sitting down with us today, and I hope that you keep us in the loop about what's going on in Amjanung so that we can stay in touch.
All right, that was an interview that Irene Dambrionis and I did with Vanessa Gray. To finish off the show, I have a quick interview I did with John Mowat-Steven, who traveled on the Action Bus with the caravan as far as Houston, where he parted ways with the group and carried on to join the Tahltan First Nation in their resistance work at the Sacred Headwaters. We chatted very briefly on the bus as we headed in to Houston.
You traveled with us so far. You're getting off at Houston, and you're going on to do similar work but different work. Can you explain the work that you're going on to do?
I'm going up to join friends in the Tahltan community at Iskut and talk with them about ways that I might be able to support them in their efforts to protect the Sacred Headwaters, which is their ancestral territory.
Can you explain the Sacred Headwaters to me?
One of the main points about the Sacred Headwaters is that it is the headwaters of three major salmon-bearing rivers in northern BC. All together, thousands of square miles of watershed, very valuable territory. Three major salmon-bearing rivers: the Stikine, the Nass, and the Skeena. They all arise in a wetland meadow at the heart of the Sacred Headwaters, and the Sacred Headwaters region has been described by the Sierra Club of BC as the largest remaining intact predator-prey ecosystem in North America, and it's also been called the Serengeti of Canada. It's virtually a pristine natural environment that's is a very unusual diversity of wildlife, flora and fauna, both there. Some species varieties of wildlife that are just not found anywhere else. The Tahltan have been, it is their ancestral territory. There's archaeological evidence of them having been resident in that area for many thousands of years. And until relatively recently, it was just in the early 1970s that a road was put through the Tahltan territory. It was called the Stewart-Cassiar Highway. And until then, there was relatively little contact with the outside world, you might call it. Tahltan have been described as semi-nomadic hunters, trappers, and gatherers, and they've been making their living from their land according to the ways of their ancestors and their own culture for a very long time, and they're making a very good effort to protect that. And there's a particular organization, the Skeena Watershed Conservation Coalition, that's based in Hazelton, B.C. It's a very strong supporter of the Tahltan and work that I do there. And also there's a group called Klibona Keepers, which is a group of Tahltan elders, predominantly women. The Tahltan are a matriarchal society. And the Klibona Keepers are the main protectors of the Sacred Headwaters area, with support from outside organizations like the Skeena Watershed Group.
How long have you been involved doing this work with them?
The main start for me was last year. I've been interested for a long time, for many years, in this region of northern BC. And it was just last year I had an opportunity to go there and to meet firsthand with Tahltan people and to start to learn ways that I might be of support.
Do you have a long history in this kind of activism and healthy environmental activism?
Not so much. Of course, I've been concerned about environmental issues for a long time, but I have been interested in North Central BC for many years. It was reading about early travel and exploration in this region that brought me out here to BC in the first place from Ontario. Just really intrigued by this wonderful vast wilderness area. Wilderness from the point of view of a kid growing up in Toronto. But, I mean, for the Tahltan, they say, this is not wilderness, this is our home, this is our kitchen, this is our home,
Are you optimistic when it comes to kind of like solidarity work? Are you optimistic that the side you're with will prevail?
I have a lot of confidence in the and admiration, for the strength of the Tahltan.
All right, thank you.
Tuesdays from 5 to 6:30 p.m. Tune in to hear the strange, experimental, outsider artists making lo-fi bedroom sounds across this massive country of ours. This is True North, only on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
Okay, that was an interview with John Mowat-Steven. He was on the action bus that was going to the Unistoten Action Camp as far as Houston, and then he parted ways with us. If you're interested in finding out more about the Unistoten blockade, you can visit unistotencamp.com. That's UNISTOTENCAMP.com. If you're interested in learning more about the Chemical Valley and that earlier interview, there's a good video up on YouTube that Vice has done called Canada's Toxic Chemical Valley that also features Vanessa Gray, who we heard from earlier in the hour. Thank you for tuning in. Don't forget that Guerrilla Radio has now moved to Wednesdays from 1 to 2 p.m. That is starting next week on the 13th. So if you're tuning in Monday evenings now to hear Guerrilla Radio, it has moved. Thank you for joining me this fine evening. I'm going to play a little bit of music now as we head out. Arnold will be in at 6 o'clock to play some jazz for you. I'm Liz MacArthur. Thanks for tuning in. Again, if you want to hear the podcast, cfuv.uvic.ca.